For the week of March 20th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 97, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And on Mars, I'm Michael Giltz.
It must be hard to breathe up there.
No, I have a suit.
Okay. Did you have a good week?
My mom says hi. Yes, I did have a good week. I've been seeing a lot of theater lately. I saw Priscilla, Queen of the Desert on Broadway, which was not good.
It wasn't good, but the movie was good. But that was in the early 1990s. So
yeah, the show actually feels like it was made in the early 90s. Its politics feel a little dated, which is kind of nice in a way that a film about gay rights could feel so dated within 10 years. But there you are.
Okay, and I know that the costume designer who wore, she won an Academy Award for her work on the film.
Yeah, it was a team of two people, and they're involved in this show as well. They did all the costumes, and that's fun, but a silly costume only goes so far.
And that silly costume that she wore to the Academy Awards was why I remember her, because she wore an entire dress made out of American Express gold cards.
That's right. Yeah, that was cool.
I mean, is it getting good reviews?
No, I mean, it's getting mixed reviews. Some people are being friendly, like, oh, it's silly and fun. I'm surprised, actually, that it got any decent reviews at all. But the Times gave it a bad review, and I gave it a bad review. So I guess that's it for the show.
Well, for the Times, I'm sure you're talking about the New York Times there.
Yes.
And we'll be talking a lot about the New York Times today, because on today's show, we'll actually be talking to Brooks Barnes of the New York Times about what Hollywood and the rest of us are learning from the flop Mars Needs Moms, which is why Michael was on Mars. You see how that kind of ties together there? Anyway, that's the recent Disney animated release. We'll be talking to Brooks Barnes about that. We'll talk a little bit about South by Southwest, an event that neither Michael nor I attended, so we should be really well informed about that. We can also fill you in on how to become an overnight pop sensation a la Rebecca Black. And if you don't know who that is, well, just wait until the middle of the show and we'll fill you in. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one film at the box office, thanks to a shiny little pill, is Limitless, the thriller starring Bradley Cooper that grossed $18.9 million. And number two was Rango, the Johnny Depp animated film that grossed $15 million, a pretty good hold in its third weekend. It's at $92 million total in the U.S., And number three, Battle Los Angeles, which grossed $14 million. That was a pretty strong drop of 60% in its second weekend, and that's at $60 million total for a movie that cost $70 million to make. And number four, another new film, The Lincoln Lawyer, starring Matthew McConaughey. That's the lawyer in a car movie, and that grossed $13.2 million. And number five, the final new release in the top 10, Paul, the film about an alien visiting America. It's from the guys who brought you Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. That grossed $13 million in the U.S. It's already grossed $40 million worldwide for a pretty modestly budgeted film. And number six, Red Riding Hood, which dropped another 50% and grossed $7 million. It's at $25 million total. At number seven, the Matt Damon film, The Adjustment Bureau, at $5.7 million. And number eight, Mars Needs Moms, which only dropped 23%, giving it another weekend grossing $5.3 million. That's at $15 million total for a movie that cost $150 million to make.
Well, think about it. If you're already close to the floor, you really don't have that much far to fall.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. Somebody could say, oh, hey, it had a good hold and people liked it. No, it just really, it's going to make some money in two weekends when you spend that much to promote it. And number nine, Beastly, the Alex Pettyfer film, that's at $22 million total. And at number 10, the Judd Apatow film, Hall Pass, which grossed $2.5 million for $40 million.
Wait
total.
A second. Was that a Judd Apatow film or a Farley Brothers movie?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a Farley Brothers. They're beginning to blur in my mind, aren't they? Thank you.
And all those raunchy comedies. What can you do?
So business was down 10% from the same weekend last year. Looking at the grosses, though, the top five films all grossed $13 million or more. So that's five movies that are over $10 million, which is a pretty good barometer that people are going to the movies. They're just not liking what they see. I look at that and see people trying lots of different movies and just not getting excited too much about any one of them.
Well, I think attendance is also down. It's not just the money. But then you have to remember that last year at this time, Avatar was just beginning to trail off.
That's true. But nonetheless, I went back 5-6 years. This is the only March where you see five movies grossing over $10 million. That's a pretty healthy indicator that people are going to the movies. It just works out that they're just not excited that much by what they're seeing. And that's happened a lot this year. There was another weekend with 6 movies grossing more than $10 million, and another weekend with 5 movies grossing over $10 million. That's not that common, actually. Usually the attention gets focused on 2 or 3 movies at the very top, or even 4. So I think people are there, they're waiting. They just want a good movie to get excited about.
Well, I think that if you're going back 5, 6 years to look at what the grosses were on the top 5 films and whether they were over $10 or $13 million, I think, A, you probably have too much time on your hands. but secondly, I would ask, what was the cumulative gross for those top 5 films year to year? Did it go from, say, the top 5 films in year 1 being $100 million all cum to it being $50 million all cum the second or third or fourth year, or even this year? So,
well, you're confusing me, but there have been big hits in March, like 300 and other films that have grossed a lot of money and that opened in March. And so when there's a big hit film, then the top 2 or 3 movies make a lot of money, and then 4 and 5 and 6 aren't doing that well. So movies have made a lot more than this weekend. The top movie only grossed $19 million. The bottom one only grossed $13 million. So you add them all up, it's not that much. One movie that grossed $40 million is doing a lot better. Just the general idea is that when there's a strong gross for, you know, 10, you know, 5 movies in the top 10, that they're all grossing a decent amount of money, that means people are going to the movies and they're just sampling everything.
Yeah, well, and Limitless is a relativity release, so for them, it's a big deal. It's the highest grossing Bradley Cooper star to, you know.
Well, that's not true. I mean,
parsing it. I mean,
Hangover grossed more than $18 million in its opening weekend.
Was he the star of that film?
Nobody else was, absolutely.
Well, I guess he was, you know, a co-star.
He was the star.
Okay, well, yeah. Well, it's certainly the biggest opening for Matthew McConaughey in a non-comedy, non-action film.
You shouldn't even say that. that's a sort of silly thing Hollywood does.
Yes.
But
I like to parse these things just to kind of irk you a bit, just to rib you a little bit.
A $13 million opener is not great, not terrible. You know, if it holds and does really well, then great that he's done his job. You know, he did his job. He got people into the theater, but it's not exactly a wow of an opener.
Into the theater. He never even had to leave his car.
Yeah. And of course, in fun news is that the concert film Justin Bieber, Never Say Never, just squeaked by Michael Jackson's This Is It to become the highest grossing concert film on record in North America.
Hold on. I'm just listening to the plane land behind you.
Yeah, I can hear that too.
At the airport?
No, I'm at home. It grossed $72.2 million, just edging about like $72.01 million or whatever Michael Jackson made. But Michael Jackson is way ahead worldwide because his film grossed $180 million overseas. No other concert film is even close. I mean, not even a tenth of that practically. And so Justin Bieber's not going to come close to that. So Michael Jackson has the worldwide record of $250 million, and Justin Bieber has passed him in North America.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if people even know who Justin Bieber is overseas. I know they do in Japan, but in Europe, do they even know who this guy is?
Well, few people are as big a star as Michael Jackson, but he has success overseas. He's been around the world.
Well, you know who doesn't have success right now is Robert Zemeckis, the filmmaker behind such hits as Back to the Future and, well, I guess Forrest Gump would be another big film that he's directed. But he's also made a number of animated films like Polar Express and last year's A Christmas Carol, which didn't do too well. And now he's produced Mars Needs Moms. Or is it Mars Needs a Mom? Mars Needs Moms.
Mars Needs Paying Customers.
Right. Well, that voice you hear is actually Brooks Barnes of the New York Times, a staff reporter there, who wrote a piece on Mars Needs Moms. And about why it flopped at the box office. It's a Disney animated film. These few films usually don't flop. So, Brooks, why did it tank?
Well, there are many fingers being pointed, as usually is the case when something this expensive, $175 to $200 million conservatively estimated. The reasons sort of range from the style of animation, which Zemeckis has sort of become obsessed with and audiences have not, to the crowding at the box office with family films, 3D pricing, a lot of factors.
Well, that style of animation is kind of a motion capture. It's not computer animated or hand-drawn. It's actually, there are actors acting out the film with motion capture suits on an empty set, and then the animation is placed over that. And I guess James Cameron did the same thing for Avatar, but Avatar seemed to work better.
Well, the thing with Zemeckis is that he is the focus that he wants is to try to make it look as real as possible. He wants to try to create a, sort of a portrait of these actors. So it's actually a sort of humanized look, as opposed to Cameron, who is using a slightly more advanced version, frankly, and is not trying to make it look like, you know, you're looking in a mirror, but it's like an animated mirror. They're blue creatures. A lot of people talk about what they don't like about Zemeckis's style of motion capture. It's that there's this attempt at realism that makes people feel a little creepy. They have sort of these dead eyes, and no matter how much they say that they fixed that problem, audiences don't seem to buy it.
Yeah, and of course he used that on The Polar Express, which was an adaptation of the Chris Van Allsburg picture book. And that actually was pretty fairly commercially successful. They re-released it several years in a row. It did decently at the box office. It had legs and sort of performed well. So that's probably one reason why Disney let him stick with it for future films like this, I guess. But Beowulf didn't do very well. A Christmas Carol was okay, not a flop like this, obviously. But this one they really rejected completely.
It's when the audience rejects something so completely, which is what happened in this case, $6.9 million in tickets on its opening weekend against that budget, against that level of marketing. You really have to wonder, okay, it's telling us something. You know, it's not just that we didn't make a very good movie, which everyone kind of agrees is the case here. Certainly critics did, but you have to look at, and Hollywood in general looks at these sort of instances as, okay, something that we're doing is wrong. And a lot of people in the animation community, the Pixars, the DreamWorks, the new folks at Illumination, which made just Despicable Me, they're, you know, sort of loathe to be roped into the same category as this. And for good reason, you know, Pixar stands above all of these films. But at the end of the day, they are all family films with animation to some degree or another, or a style or another. And you have to start thinking, is there gridlock to the point that audiences are just not going to be, these films are not going to be as reliable as they have been for the last decade.
So what you're saying is there might be some oversaturation in the computer animated family film market. But would you also, would you also say, as somebody who has two children and takes them to the movies every now and again, that the 3D ticket prices are really kind of a hindrance? Going to the movies for a family of four can cost anywhere between $30 and $45 just for the tickets. So are these premium prices for 3D, which a lot of these movies now are, is that getting in the way?
Absolutely. I mean, the part of the reason that studios have pursued this 3D component of family films in particular is that there's not that much of a break on kids' prices for 3D screenings. You know, it's like something like $15 or $16 for an IMAX screening, $13 for kids to get into a regular 3D screening, and that's a lot of money. And so, just anecdotally, you know, I've heard, I guess I would loop my own family into that. After a while, you're sort of like, oh my God, every weekend I'm paying this sort of a lot, and some of these movies haven't been that great. This followed right on the heels of Romeo and Juliet. You know, when you look at the box office overall, you've got Rango, you've got Hop coming, there's Rio 2 weeks later, Kung Fu Panda 2 right behind it, and audiences have no choice but to become more picky.
Well, I feel like I've been a big criticizer of the 3D prices. I don't think they should charge a premium for 3D cinema at all any more than they should charge extra for sound or color. I think it's just something they should be happy keeps people coming to the movies. But I mean, when a movie is rejected this completely, I feel like it can't just be the 3D prices, but I feel like the glut overall of movies for family makes them be more selective because they've got five movies coming up, like you say. And you said something in your article, you said, you know, this is the first digital animated film to really flop. And I thought, well, gosh, that can't be true. And I went online and I went through all these lists of movies, and it was very hard to find an earlier example of a digital animated film that had collapsed this completely at the box office. The closest I could come were Delgo, this very little known fantasy sci-fi film, which cost $50 million and grossed less than $1 million, and Everyone's Hero, this animated film about a kid who loves baseball, that cost about $40 or $50 million and grossed only $17 million worldwide. But that's out of a list of dozens and dozens of movies. So really, in a way, it wasn't this sort of subgenre of computer animated films due for a flop anyway. You just can't expect any particular genre to always succeed.
Yes. I mean, this is sort of the what happens in Hollywood over and over. For the last decade or so, with the success of Pixar and DreamWorks, every studio started realizing, wow, you know, it's a ton of money, $150 million pretty much is the starting point for most of these movies, and just for the production cost, not marketing, but they're reliable. They've you know, performed both here and overseas, and so all of these studios, Sony, Universal, Paramount, just had Rango, its first animated film at this level. They've all sort of rushed toward that pot of gold, but as often happens, that then it starts getting oversaturated and the audience starts getting more selective, as you said, and then the laser eye of Hollywood starts looking elsewhere. I'm not saying that's going to happen just because of one flop, but it's something that you know, people were sort of, it's a turning point.
But there might be some other business reasons besides the fact that the movie just wasn't very good and there are 3D prices and there's an oversaturation. Some of those business reasons, and you point them out in your piece, are that in the middle of last year, or at the beginning of last year, Dick Cook, who ran Disney for 20-some-odd years, was kind of ousted, in large part due to Robert Zemeckis' A Christmas Carol adaptation flopping at the box office. And Rich Ross came in. He was given the head of the Disney film studios, or at least the film division. And
right.
He took a look at Mars Needs Moms and said, you know what, this is horrible, but we're too far into it. He then turned around and, I guess, put the kibosh on Zemeckis' adaptation of the 1968 Beatles film, The Yellow Submarine, which was an animated
right.
film, and he was going to be making that. But, I mean, so that has been kind of in turnaround, Yellow Submarine, that is, for some time now, even though we're just finding out about it.
A couple months, they say, was the final sort of pulling of the plug on that. It wasn't largely because of Christmas Carol. It was definitely a part of it. And it wasn't necessarily the performance of it at the box office. It was that he doubled down so hard on it in the marketing that we had, you know, the Christmas train crossing the country for like 6 months ahead of time. And that sort of view of marketing was what led Bob Iger to sort of focus a little heavily on that part. But
Bob Iger being the CEO of Disney.
Right, right. But the point here is that you, as a new movie head, you're not invested in this. You know, I don't know how many years this must have been in production and development, but when you have that level of investment, you care a lot more about whether it's going to succeed or not. And you never want to put a movie out there and not support it with everything you have. I think that Disney would really, and Ross and his folks would really argue strongly that they did support it with everything they have. I don't think that the rest of the town would think that, the industry, because the marketing felt a little tepid. It felt, you know, like, okay, we've got to run through the hurdles on this, but it didn't feel inspired.
So what does this mean for the other digital capture movies that are in the works? Obviously, no one is worried about Avatar. Steven Spielberg right. is working on Tintin, which is an adaptation of the long-running comic book series. Is that different enough in style from the Zemeckis style that it's not an issue as far as that creepiness people talk about?
People really don't know. That's kind of the next test. This is, I'm pretty sure, Spielberg's first time working this extensively with that kind of filmmaking, and you know, we'll have to wait and see. No one's seen any of the footage yet.
Well, and overall for Disney, Mars Needs Moms, I was reading someplace, the Hollywood Reporter, that it will wipe out only about 1% of their earnings for this fiscal year because they've already taken a huge write down on Image Movers Digital,
only is a lot for an big gigantic company like that. For one movie to affect the entire overall earnings is pretty bad.
Right.
It's pretty bad. You know, I think they've already taken $100 million write down, which is not you know, a small chunk of change, and at least tens of millions more are expected because of the performance. I mean, it wasn't just here that the picture didn't work. Overseas, the numbers have been really, really grim. So it's definitely a problem.
And obviously, when a disaster strikes, like in Japan, that's people first and foremost think about the human cost. But big multinational corporations like the Hollywood studios have to look at one of their major markets being basically shut down for months, if not longer. It's
right.
it's a cruel, terrible thing to think about, but it is going to affect their earnings and their business and how they approach the international market. This is something that obviously is going to affect Disney, especially because they have a Disneyland Tokyo. So this is something that's really going to affect them, as you know, even harder than the other studios over the next year or so.
Yes, Disneyland Tokyo is an interesting anomaly for the company in that they don't actually own it. They just license the rights to a company there called the Oriental Land Company. So although it will definitely impact their cash flow, it wouldn't impact them to the degree that it would one of the parks they own, which are all the other ones.
But do studios say we should delay some movies maybe for 6 months, or are they adjusting their international plans or looking at that or thinking about that in any way?
To the movie point, yes. The window in Japan for spring break is considered, you know, one of the biggest opportunities there of the year. And in fact, Tangled, which we saw last Thanksgiving, was just set to open there as the earthquake and tsunami hit. So that's going to be a big disappointment for them.
Well, and Warner Brothers has pulled Hereafter, which features a tsunami in it. So they pulled that out of theaters.
And I should point it to Tangled as a great example. People wrote off hand-drawn animation and said, oh, that's dead. We can only make computer animated movies. That's all that will ever work ever again. And of course, Tangled is hand-drawn basically, and that certain style. And it was a terrific hit all over the world. And I think the same is probably true for digital capture and any other style of animation or filmmaking that you can talk about. Make the right movie in the right style, and it's going to work.
That's a really good point.
Well, Brooks, thank you very much for taking the time to join us and talk about Mars Needs Moms, not Mars Needs a Mom, and for kind of filling us in on all of the problems and grievances. I don't know what the correct word is there, but the difficulty with this particular film.
Definitely some people grieving, I would say.
especially Robert Zemeckis.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Sure, thanks.
Bye.
Well, that was interesting. Yeah. It was great to get Brooks Barnes on the phone for the New York Times. He's obviously a terrific writer. And it's a little sad for Robert Zemeckis. I mean, he's a good director, and he's had this sort of weird foray into animation, kind of like George Miller in Australia. Zemeckis has done The Polar Express and Beowulf and A Christmas Carol, and he's produced animated films like Mars Needs Moms. And he seems to have lost interest in live-action movies like Castaway and Forrest Gump and Back to the Future and, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand and all those sort of movies.
Well, yeah, and it would be nice to see Zemeckis return to movies like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is one of my favorite films. I believe it's one of yours as well.
Absolutely.
And certainly I'd like to thank Brooks Barnes as well. We'll place links to his work in the show notes. You know, we feature a lot of work from the New York Times, so it's nice to actually have one of their journalists join us on the show.
Definitely.
And we should probably actually move on to music, where this past week, if you were on the internet at all, there is no doubt that you probably ran across a few dozen stories about South by Southwest. Now, South by Southwest started in 1987 as a kind of a showcase for local musicians and regional, so to speak, musicians. And everybody kind of gathered in Austin, and for 4 or 5 days, they would play these showcases for A&R and record executives and managers and labels, effectively.
And now it's just become a complete arts and cultural event. I mean, there are movies screened there and documentaries and fiction films and artists and painters. I mean, there's just everything going on now.
Well, there are three different categories or kind of, I don't know, why can't I find words today? I'm out of all my words, which is it's bad to actually try and host a show when you're out of words. But there are three divisions, if you will, or sides to the festival. There's film, which started after music. Then there's interactive, so it's all the web stuff. So all the Twitters and Facebooks. Twitter actually launched at South by Southwest back in 2007. So that's how important South by Southwest is to interactive. But then there's music. And music has always been what South by Southwest was about. And this year there were 4 days, Wednesday through Saturday. And there was an increase in attendance, up 30%.
That's a lot.
Now, did you follow any of the news?
No, I didn't. I mean, I just caught up on it at the end. But basically, it's a show that's just gotten too big for its britches. I mean, there's just too many people. They're just not, they don't have the structure there to support all those people coming to all those shows.
Right. They do a lot of free shows. So they'll do, you know, a whole afternoon of free shows at a venue or outside. There's a lot of shows outside. In fact, Jack White of the White Stripes this year took a mobile record store to Austin and then performed outside.
Oh, that's cool.
He came out. And the one thing that's interesting about South by Southwest and events like it now is that they are so overly documented because everybody with their iPhone or their cameras and Flickr and YouTube, it's instantaneous documentation. So right. It's not just one person with a camera, it's everybody with a camera. So Jack White steps out of his mobile record store with his guitar to sing one or two songs and he says, wow, I see more black boxes than faces.
And what went wrong this year? Was it that it coincided with St. Patrick's Day, or does it always do that?
For me, the reason I've never been and I've always wanted to go is it just comes at a bad time of year around Show West and this year CinemaCon. So it is around St. Patrick's Day. It's always held in March, not necessarily overlapping St. Patrick's Day, but this year it did. And on that Thursday, which was St. Patrick's Day, a bunch of unruly crowds got shut out of some shows. One was by Death From Above 1979, which was a reunited act. You know, there was a bit of a riot that broke out there, and police on horseback had to be called in, which only exacerbated the situation. There was at Stubbs Barbecue, which is one of the big venues there, an illegal camera crane fell on a crowd. There was an incident where one of the bands, the bassist for one of the bands, got into an argument and fist fight with some of the audience. I mean, it just was.
Stroke show created problems. They've just got too many people for the way the show's been run all these years.
Yes, and really, it's turned into not only a show for labels and managers to go and find new talent, but also for big name artists to bring their new albums to. And so,
yeah, the Strokes were there.
They weren't the only ones. Kanye West and Jay-Z performed. It's a big event now, and it has both fans and industry folks all convening in Austin for 4 days, and it's just too small a place to hold the event.
And so this means, is it becoming too much of a pain for industry people? Are there too many fans there now, and so it's not going to be worth the bother? I mean, it's sort of not about discovering new acts as it used to be. It used to be just like Sundance would say, oh, we've discovered a new filmmaker. South by Southwest would say, oh, here's a new talent that the record labels are excited by. That doesn't seem to be as much about it anymore. It seems to be more of a festival.
It does seem to be more of a festival now, although I do think it is still about discovering new acts. For certain people, it's about discovering new acts, but they really have to work a lot harder at it. And speaking of discovering new acts, by the way, have you watched this Rebecca Black video? And do you even know who I'm talking to?
Friday. Yes, I have seen it.
Okay, yeah. I was wondering if you knew who I was talking about. But when I started first seeing headlines about this particular person, Rebecca Black, appear in my RSS reader, I thought, who the heck is this person? What is she talking about Friday for? That was a film that, you know, Ice Cube started. I mean, what is the deal here? And why is she being cyberbullied? And so I, you know, poked around a bit and found out that she's an Orange County, California 8th grader. She's 13 years old. Her mother paid, according to many reports, $2,000 to a vanity label called Arc Music. And this label takes effectively preteen and teenage girls and turns them into the quote-unquote Britney Spears pop stars by writing a song for them, recording the song, and making a little music video. And it turns
out... that's all it cost? Because I thought the video, people have mocked the video, but I thought it looked perfectly fine. It looked like something you'd see on Disney or MTV.
I know, I was really surprised. I mean, it looked a little on the low budget side, but it still looked okay. I mean, it didn't look horrible. Didn't look like
And she's gotten how many views on YouTube?
I think she's well past 30 million at this point, in under a week.
30?
Yeah, 30 million.
Wow.
Yeah, in under a week. Now, the reason we're talking about this, of course, is...
Well, it says 13 million here. Are you sure it's 30?
I think there's different...
Okay.
Different videos. But now, you know, there's also tons of remixes, tons of kind of satirical takeoffs on it.
Yeah.
She was on Good Morning America. She's been a trending topic on Twitter that ranked above Charlie Sheen at times. So that should tell you, pretty much people were talking about Rebecca Black and this video.
Well, where does the cyberbullying come in?
Well, apparently people think that the lyrics are somewhat banal, since the one of them is about,
Saturday comes after Friday and Sunday comes after Saturday.
Yeah, pretty much. Kicking it in the front seat, kicking it in the back. Time magazine said that, it's nice that, instead of being in the back seat, we're talking about being in the front seat, for teenage girls. And, they're more wholesome now.
So is it just people saying this video sucks, or are people literally like stalking and harassing her on her own Facebook and all that sort of thing?
No, I think it's more that they're saying, negative things on YouTube. They're saying negative things on Twitter. They're saying...
Well, that's not cyberbullying, is it?
Yeah, that's what cyberbullying...
No, cyberbullying is not when you post a music video for a song and they say, I don't like this song. Cyberbullying is when somebody harasses you personally and says, you're a jerk, nobody likes you, and targets you out of nowhere for just, and on a personal level.
Well, they are saying things like, we hope you die, we hope you get an eating disorder, we hope you cut yourself.
But when you've posted a music video on YouTube and spent to promote a song, that's just not, to me, you're putting yourself out there to say, look at me and judge me.
Okay, that I will agree with. Yes,
I'm not agreeing. Right. Someone should say, I hope you die and get an eating disorder. But I don't think you can be accused of cyberbullying Selena Gomez or Britney Spears. You can be mean in spirit and tacky and cruel and I'm not nice. But that's not cyberbullying. Cyberbullying should be saved for I'm go to school with you and I start mocking you online to make your life a living hell. Not you're on a TV show and I say you're fat. That's not cyberbullying.
Well, needless to say, she has been mocked endlessly. Yahoo asked whether the YouTube sensation Rebecca Black's Friday is the worst song ever recorded.
Oh, not even close. Come on. I thought it was actually kind of catchy.
Tosh.0 said that it was, that songwriting is not for everyone was his...
Well, but she didn't write the song, did she?
No, she did not write the song. And she said that she didn't really necessarily even like it all that much, but she kind of understood that chorus was kind of a nice hook.
Whoever wrote it is rich right now, or at least making more money. I don't know what it's selling as a digital single, but as a YouTube, it's making some money. And as a digital single, it could be making more. But has she not been picked up by a label yet?
I don't know. We should find out. Simon Cowell said that anybody that creates this much talk in under a week is somebody I want to meet.
Exactly. He's no fool. Yeah. He likes to make money.
Yeah, that's right. And
another person who likes to make money is Eminem.
Oh, my goodness. And he may as well just go straight to the bank and wait for the trucks to back up, because the Supreme Court just put close to about $40 or $50 million in his pocket and his former production company's pocket. But it's a very interesting and controversial ruling. Do you want to tell us about it?
He was in a dispute with Universal Music Group over payments for songs that were sold as digital download tracks and ringtones.
That's right. Yeah, his contract was cut before the big MP3 revolution, before iTunes became such a big seller of music.
Right, and apparently Universal did not renegotiate or make clear what royalty rate should apply to digital tracks and ringtones, which obviously is a huge number of sales, especially for rap stars. And they just decided, well, we're going to pay you 18% just like we do on CDs. And his people said, no, this isn't actually a sale. This is more like a licensing agreement. And that means you owe us 50% of the net revenue.
A federal court agreed with them, basically.
That's right. And then it went to the Supreme Court and they just chose not to deal with it, right? Or did they vote?
They said, look, you know what? We're not going to hear the case. You got to go back to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, because it looks like there's no reason to bring it to the Supreme Court. The Court of Appeals did the right thing.
Right. When they declined to hear it, that means they have no issue with the ruling that was made for whatever reason.
Correct.
Yeah. And but this isn't going to have a big impact on other artists, is it?
Well, a lot of other artists had their contracts renegotiated. So, it used to be that if somebody licensed your music for a television show or for a movie, that the artist would get 50%. Well, for iTunes, when you buy an iTunes song, you're not buying it. You can't resell that MP3 legally.
Nice.
You are licensing it. So it doesn't really ever physically belong to you or legally belong to you. It still belongs to the record company and the artist. So what Eminem was saying, as you mentioned, was, hey, this is a license, I get 50%. And they never went back to Eminem and knocked on his door and said, hey, we want to renegotiate that back down to 18%.
Or come up with something we can all agree on.
Right. And so because of that, all of those iTunes sales, all of those ringtone sales, they're going to be paid out at 50% for Eminem. Maybe not for everybody else, but what people are saying and pundits are saying now is that every artist is going to start looking at their contract and going back to their record companies and saying, you know what? Actually, you owe me 50% for all those iTunes songs.
But most people have already, that's already not an issue.
That's what Universal Music Group is saying.
Universal or industry experts. I think most artists either have come on since the MP3 revolution or they've come up with a new agreement, surely.
Yeah, I would imagine you're. I mean, it's hard to go back to an artist as successful as Eminem and say, we want to renegotiate this one little clause in your contract.
Well, no, it's not hard. Not when something new comes up like ringtones. It's an entirely new business. We say, hey, we haven't done this before. He says, oh, I think I deserve this. And they say, we think you deserve that. And you come up with an agreement. I don't think
it's ringtones fall under licensing. And licensing is certainly
they don't
in
need
the contract.
To. And it's new when they've never sold a ringtone before. And it comes up and they say, what is this new thing? Let's decide. That's what negotiations are for. I don't think it would be difficult.
Well, I'll say this. When there's a clause in a contract, and I should look up what the name of this clause is, that is considered, I don't know the right
legal
word
term
for this clause, where they say, we own this in its current form, and we own the
and all other forms that will ever exist in history.
Right, correct. And that is pretty much why you need to go back and renegotiate that particular clause.
Yeah, well, so it's a big deal.
So it is a big deal, yes. And in fact, I think if you were to ask me, it's probably time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. What do you say?
I say let's do it.
Okay, well, you know what? Our first story is about television. Fox won the Wednesday night ratings race thanks to American Idol, which is now scoring higher ratings than it did 1 year ago in its ninth season. In second place in primetime was CBS. And who do you think was in third place? Was it ABC? Was it NBC? Nope. It was Univision, the Latino channel, which trounced the reruns on ABC and NBC's increasingly rocky primetime lineup. Is this victory by Univision a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's a growing market. They're becoming a huge part of the population. In California, whites are a minority. You've got to look at the Latino and Black and other populations in this country, the Asian population. And this reflects what a big growing market they are.
The New York Times is launching its paywall on March 28th in the U.S. This was my favorite story of the week. The most frustrating, pissed off. Anyway, if you're not a subscriber, you'll still be able to read 20 articles a month on their website. And if you are clicking on a link posted on Twitter, Facebook, or even most blogs, you can still read the article, even if you've already reached your personal 20 article limit. There will be a 5-article cap for clicking on an article you found by searching on Google to avoid that little loophole. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I can't wait to hear what you say. I think it's not as big a deal as it should be because it seems like there are a lot of ways to get around this.
There are a lot of ways to get around it. Of course, they closed that Google loophole, which the Wall Street Journal never did. But let me tell you something. I don't mind paying for news. I really don't. And especially the New York Times. It is the voice of America as far as I'm concerned. Well, one of the voices of America as far as I'm concerned. And I go there every day, numerous times a day. They've got great writing. We just talked to Brooks Barnes. I mean, I don't mean to tout it too much. I just think it's one of the better media outlets in the United States.
In the world. It's a major, major institution.
Correct. Now, so I don't mind paying for that. So if they said to me, look, you know what? We really need to make some money. We need to make, give me $100 for the year. I would have said, gee, shucks, that's too expensive. And then paid it. But what they're charging is $15 per month to get it online and on your cell phone. And if you want it on your iPad, as well as your cell phone and online, it's
$30. $30 extra or $30 total?
Is it $30 or $35? It's $35. So it's $20 if you want it on iPad and online. It's $15 if you want it on phone and online. And I think it's $30 or $35 if you want it on the phone, online.
You're confusing people. It's $180 a year minimum to get the Times.
Yes. It's too expensive.
Yeah, and especially if you only want digital only. I know they say, oh, but that's crazy. You know what? Historically, the cost of a newspaper only covered the printing and getting it to your door. It didn't pay for the creating of the content or anything. So when you eliminate all those costs to tell me, oh, it should still needs to cost $180, $200 a year, it's a big, big, big chunk.
I mean, they're trying not to gut their paper sales, and I get that. And if you are a subscriber, you do get free access. So if you get the paper version on your doorstep, then you can also get it online.
But the paper version is more than $180, obviously.
Yes, it is. I thought about that little loophole, too. I thought, well, maybe I'll
Somebody said you can buy the Sunday Times only and get access.
You can if you live in California.
You can't?
No, you have to get Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Ah, okay.
Which costs a mint, and you may as well, at that point, pay the $15.
And obviously the loopholes we talk about, like if Huffington Post links to a New York Times article, you can still read it no matter what, but it's going to be very hard to say, oh, I want to see if they reviewed this play or movie and just go there and do it. And you can work around it, but it's a pain in the neck. So are other people going to imitate this? Have they got the formula right? I'm sure we'll find out over time and they'll adjust.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think everybody will be looking at this to see how much money they make off of it, whether the Washington Post or the LA Times or another media outlet then becomes more of an influencer in media. It's a big risk. They had to do something. It was a long time coming and they had to do something. But I just think $15 is way too much to get news on your online.
And the iPad thing is crazy to make that some sort of extra charge to double or increase it that much. I mean, if they said, you know, $50 a year, I would sign up for it immediately.
I know. Look, I pay for NPR. I pay $100, $125 a year gladly.
Wow, that's a lot.
And I would gladly do the same for the New York Times.
But that's $120. That's not that different from $180. I mean, it's 50% more, but it seems in the ballpark. So what do you pay $120 for?
Well, here in Los Angeles, KCRW has this program where it's a fringe benefits card. They give you this little membership card. And there are different businesses, hundreds if not thousands of businesses in Los Angeles and even throughout the country that accept this card and give you a discount. As well, for $100, I get 3 or 4 CDs along with that. So
you're supporting, you're donating money to support them. You could access NPR whenever you want for free.
Yes, correct.
Okay. Well, this is the not so lightning round of big deal, big whoop, but that was an exciting story.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly one we'll be talking about, I'm sure, down the road. Speaking of things we've talked about before, Charlie Sheen is in demand, according to Charlie Sheen. His people say CBS has approached them about getting the actor back to work on 2 and a Half Men. Meanwhile, Sheen is launching a multi-city comedy tour that has already sold out in some cities. Michael, I think even in New York at Radio City Music Hall, it's sold out.
Oh, gee.
Fox is talking with Sheen about doing something like launching a late-night talk show to compete with Dave, Jay, and Conan because there aren't enough late-night talk shows in the world. This, too, appears to be according to Sheen's people. New York Magazine points out that these stories are leaking on outlets like Radar Online and TMZ that have been plugged into the Sheen camp for some time. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop until something happens, but the tour is a big deal. It's selling out. And again, I just don't think his image is damaged very much. And I think the more success he has, the harder it is for them to argue that he's a sort of incompetent fool that can't do his job.
Look up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Kevin Costner? Yes, Costner has joined the cast of the Superman reboot being directed by Zack Snyder, the guy behind 300 and Watchmen. Once upon a time, he might have been the Man of Steel himself. But that role is being played by Henry Cavill. Or is it Cavill? I don't know. Costner is playing Jonathan Kent, the adopted dad of Clark. He joins Diane Lane as Martha Kent. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's man gets jobs, so I suppose it's big whoop, but it makes me feel old to know he's now playing the father of the action hero.
Why?
I mean, I remember when he came out in Fandango and he was the body in Big Chill and Silverado. Golly, this is very makes me feel very, very old.
Well, you could be the nephew. Not the exactly. Nephew, the uncle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Duran Duran's newest concert film will be directed by David Lynch. Yes, in the latest of a string of high-profile directors helming concerts that are streamed online and backed by American Express, the Wild Boys of Duran Duran, or should I say Wild Boys of Duran Duran, will be captured by Lynch. And yes, the weirder the better as far as Duran Duran is concerned. Last year, Terry Gilliam directed an Arcade Fire concert, Spike Lee did John Legend and The Roots, while Kenny Ortega did Sugarland. It will be broadcast on March 23rd, live, and can be found on YouTube for about the next month. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. Clearly, American Express is pulling in the people they use in advertising to do these concerts. It's a little quick one-off thing. What intrigued me about this was that its concert is to celebrate the physical release of their new album, All You Need Is Now. And that's been out for like 8 months digitally or something. I mean, I got it last year. One of their songs is on my best of the year list. I'm like, what? They haven't even released the CD yet? I mean, that's what a weird world we live in.
I guess I should start boning up on my Duran Duran since they're going to be at Coachella.
It's a pretty good album, actually. It's definitely one of, it feels very much like Rio, and it's a pretty good return to form if you're a fan.
Are the glory days of 24-hour cable news channels behind us? Larry King has retired, Keith Olbermann has gone to Al Gore's Current TV, and for the first time in more than a decade, viewership is down on all three news channels, Fox, MSNBC, and CNN. However, don't panic yet, Bill O'Reilly fans. In this topsy-turvy world of television, those fewer eyeballs are now more valuable than ever because they're so hard to find. Despite the fall in ratings, all the channels saw their revenues increase over a disastrous 2009 when the recession was at its worst. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's definitely a long-term trend that they sort of peaked in popularity. Obviously, any event like the disaster in Japan will push up ratings for a few weeks or months or days, depending on what it is. But it's clearly a long-term trend that big personalities doing crazy, outrageous things like Glenn Beck has only worked so long, and now it's back down to a little more reasonable level.
It's been a not-so-quiet week at Lake Wobegon, my hometown. Should I say this in my Garrison Keillor voice?
Yes, you should.
I don't have a Garrison Keillor voice.
It's been a not-so-quiet week at Lake Wobegon, my hometown, out there on the edge of the prairie.
Garrison Keillor, the creator and host of the long-running radio show, has...
Oh, I didn't mean the whole thing.
Oh, okay. Garrison Keillor, the creator and host of the long-running radio show, has repeated his desire to retire in the next few years. Keillor says he plans to end his duties in the spring of 2013, which is kind of around the corner. He'll be 70 at that time. But the show must go on. Keillor wants to find a replacement to keep the Prairie Home Companion series going. He's going to try out guests like Sarah Watkins of the bluegrass band Nickel Creek. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal for me. I've listened to the show on and off for decades, especially when I'm on the road. That's when I always hear it. I listen to the monologue on podcast every week. And it's the end of an era. I mean, he's been doing this for how long? Decades and decades. And I love it.
Yeah, certainly they'll have to find a replacement for Guy Noir, Private Eye. They do this little radio skit. But what always amazes me about Garrison Keillor, love him or hate him, is that week after week, that guy does a monologue that is thoughtful, inventive, funny, heartfelt. It's remarkable that he can do that week after week.
Just like what priests do in sermons, which I think is a comparison he's made before.
And what we do here on Showbiz Sandbox, just without the heartfelt, without any of the humor. And
or intelligence or insight.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. The X Factor has its second judge. The Simon Cowell pretender to the American Idol throne is starting to make some official announcement. Joining Cowell on the four-person judging panel is L.A. Reid, the acclaimed producer and record label executive. I don't know why I read it that way. L.A. Reid, the acclaimed producer and record label executive. Reid is behind the signings or career resurgence of acts like Usher, Pink, Kanye West, Mariah Carey, Rihanna, and Justin Bieber, just to name a few. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal because this is a real pretender to the throne. It's going to be a real competitor, and he brings a lot of legitimacy to it, just like Jennifer Lopez and, I'm blacking out on his name. Tyler Perry is Medea. We should have Medea on as a host. That would be exciting.
Steven Tyler.
Yeah. No, L.A. Reid is a big industry figure. He's a big player. He's now going to get a deal, I think, at Sony, which is linked up to the show. He's leaving, his label to join the show and presumably the new label at Sony. The question is, what will he be like on TV? And I'm sure Simon Cowell has figured that out.
Well, he was in the Justin Bieber movie, and he was pretty good in the Justin Bieber movie. But, reality television has no writers. It's all...
Yes, they do.
Ah. Hollywood and the Writers Guild made it one in a row on contract talks. After a bitter strike paralyzed the industry in 2007, everyone expected this round of negotiations on a new three-year contract to go smoothly. The WGA got a 20% increase in pay TV residuals, a 2% increase in annual wage rates, and a bump in pension contributions from employers rising from 6% to 7.5%. The WGA failed to make any headway on basic cable residual rates, which had been a major priority. Primetime residual rates remained frozen. And worst of all, writers will probably be flying coach a lot more often. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal because you want negotiations to go smoothly and everyone to be happy and move forward. I think both sides got some things they wanted and didn't get some things they didn't want, that they tried for. And it's good for the industry. Stoppages are bad for everyone.
Wait, a contract is compromised? Since when?
Exactly.
We should have had Jonathan Handel on from The Hollywood Reporter and his, Troy Gould, the law firm, to tell us about this. We should have him on because he wrote this new book, actually. Well, I'll give him a call. Somebody call the lawyers. Hey, I was just talking about calling a lawyer. Go figure. Another movie is getting released to the world on the peer-to-peer network BitTorrent. The scourge of studios, BitTorrent is actually blameless this time around. The producers of the crowd-funded movie The Tunnel raised funds by selling, get this, individual frames of the film one by one online. They also promised to release the film for free onto BitTorrent when it got released on DVD. The DVD release will include extras and an alternate ending, which the BitTorrent version will have as well. Paramount Australia has a piece of the film, so technically a major Hollywood studio is siding with BitTorrent on this one. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I don't know what it will do for lawsuits and things when people are trying to stop pirates, but when studios start to legitimize BitTorrent and work with it and say that, yes, there is some legitimate peer-to-peer sharing that can go on and, in fact, we'll do business with them, that seems to make it very hard to turn around and sue them on the other hand.
Yes, although I did hear it suggested in one tech blog that I read that somehow Paramount was allowing this to happen so that they could get the IP addresses of all those people who were legally downloading.
Oh, you know, that's just paranoia. You're saying the producers of the film are releasing the movie so that anyone who takes the movie feed will then have their IP addresses and give them to Paramount so they can sue them.
Yes. Yeah, well, no. Not. Let me backtrack.
For other stuff.
Yes. Oh, you legally downloaded, you know, the tunnel, but we also noticed you're downloading the King's Speech. So you're sued.
They're just being paranoid. Right. But I believe the DVD will have stuff that's not available on the stream. That's the whole point.
Oh, well,
the bonus footage and the alternate ending will be available only on the DVD. They're not going to stream that. Somebody else might put it up, of course, but in the official stream on BitTorrent, it will not be there.
Well, then it darn well better be good so that I want to see that alternate ending.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know what? That's a perfect story to segue from Big Deal or Big Whoop into Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss only the stories that people in Hollywood might care about. Now, I am putting on my boxing gloves because I know that Michael and I are going to go to town on this one. We've got a lot of interesting news here that relate to television and streaming media and Netflix and DVDs. And I mean, I don't even know where to begin, Michael. Do you know where to begin?
I do know where to begin. This is basically a story about making content available to people. Cable companies want to do it. Movie rental companies like Netflix want to do it. Channels like HBO want to do it. Everybody wants to make content available to people in as many ways as possible. And they're all trying to figure out the best way to do that and how to pay for it and who's going to do it and how it's going to work. The first example is from Time Warner. They released an app so that people who are Time Warner subscribers can stream content from their TV, certain channels like CNN and so on, to their iPads and other tablet devices. Now, you have to be within your home, basically, in order for the app to work. You can't use the app at work or at the park or something like that. So you have to be within your house. But if you have a tablet or a laptop and you want to sit in your backyard or sit in your bedroom rather than in front of the TV, you can use this app and stream certain channels onto your device.
And by tablet, you mean iPad, because it's really just an iPad app. They don't have an Android app yet.
Well, it's an app for phones and other things, too. Yeah. So it depends on the device. And I think you can use it on your laptop, too. You know, you can get the app and put it on your Mac.
I don't know. I downloaded it to my iPad, and it initially had 32 channels. Then it dropped to 15, and then it started to climb back up again. And everybody thought, well, the reason that it dropped to 15 is all of these cable networks are suing them or, you know, really upset or sent cease and desist letters to Time Warner because they don't want their channels in this app.
And they're insisting Time Warner doesn't have the right to do this. And now really, they're not so upset about it because of the way it works and you have to be basically within your home, but they want to set up the precedent that they have the right to decide when and where their stuff is going to be streamed because they're worried about the next person to release an app that will make it available to do it on your subway train to work or your car ride or in the park or whatever.
Right.
And Time Warner's not the first one to do this either, right? I mean, other people, Comcast, Dish, and Cablevision all also offer similar apps.
Right. It's this TV everywhere thing so that they're saying, you know, we want to be in control of where you're going to get your content from a technological standpoint. So that way things can't be pirated and put on, I don't know, BitTorrent.
Right. But I mean, for me, it's like I pay $150 a month for my cable subscription. And why shouldn't I be able to look at my cable stuff that I access? Why do I have to be physically in this particular spot in order to get access to that? You know, that's why I pay money for Slingbox and stuff so I can watch it anywhere in the world. There's no reason why they shouldn't offer this service to you. You're paying for it. Why force you to sit in a certain physical location? It makes no sense. And
the difference between this app and Slingbox are? Is that Slingbox never really caught on in the mainstream market. There aren't tens of millions of these things out in the world. So, you know, even though technically
I'm just saying it's a service that should be provided. There's no, in this day and age, to say that I must physically be within a certain few feet of a device in order to watch my cable programming is ridiculous. And there's many ways to make that possible. One of which is an app. Another way is Slingbox. And they shouldn't have the right to fight it. I don't think it's right. I think it's a perfectly reasonable iteration of the cable service.
Well, here's where they might be in the right, at least for a very short period of time. That antiquated system we have for rating which shows are more popular than others, Nielsen, they can't seem to count the number of people watching shows through these apps and on tablets. So
that's an utterly meaningless thing. They don't count people who watch TV shows in bars or dorm rooms, you know, in dorm hall, you know, dorm halls at college. There's a million ways Nielsen needs to adapt to the future. That's not an argument for or against either the legality or the practicality of doing this.
Well, yeah, networks just fear that their ratings are going to drop if this app were to become very popular, or similar applications like it should become popular. Now, you know, really much like the New York Times wants us to pay for more functionality. If you want it online, it's $15. If you want it on your iPad as well, it's $20. Really, these content owners just want to be paid for more functionality. That's what it boils down to.
Right, but when you're already paying $100, my cable bill is so big, there's no reason why you shouldn't let me watch this on my tablet.
Especially since you can't skip the commercials on these things. You got to watch the commercials.
Right. Well, you know, and of course, this is just one of many stories. Another one is about HBO. I found this fascinating. HBO is now offering, and they've been doing HBO On Demand and letting you access multiple seasons of shows that they've offered in the past, like Sex and the City. You know, when you're at your cable thing, you can just sort of do these, you know, you can call up certain seasons when they're available. But now they're offering HBO Go. It's a free service. It lets subscribers to the cable channel access on demand virtually the entire library of HBO programming on their PC or Mac. You can watch the entire series of Sex and the City or Deadwood or The Sopranos or any of their documentaries or films or stand-up shows. Anything HBO has ever created and owns the rights to, you can watch it on demand anytime you want. That is kind of amazing.
It is kind of amazing because they have so much content. They have so many. You've named them all those series that you mentioned. I'm sure there's all those stand-up comedy bits, you know, and
there's Arliss, and there's tons of other shows. They had one of the first cable TV movies about the runner and doing the running across country, the guy with one leg or no legs, and the Terry Fox story. I mean, they just have programming going back decades.
Right. It makes it almost worth it to subscribe for $5 a month to the cable channel.
Well, it's not $5 a month. It's more like $12 for most people.
Okay, well then.
Certainly for me. But it does make me say, gee, why do I have the, you know, this is the future. I look at the string of Deadwood on Blu-ray that I have, which is great. And I think, is that going to look silly in 10 years?
I think, it'll be in a museum in 10 years or 15.
Well, and they're not the only ones. Tell me about Hulu.
Well, Hulu has been in a bidding war, and I think they won this war at the end of last week. I think HBO is who they were in the bidding war with, and I want to say USA or AMC. It was AMC and HBO bidding against Netflix for an original series, which will be directed by David Fincher and star Kevin Spacey. It's going to be called House of Cards, which is a remake of a terrific UK series about politics. Of course, they're Americanizing it. They're putting it in America, and it's going to be about a politician angling to become president. Gee, we haven't seen too many of those shows lately. And Fincher is going to be directing, I guess, I don't know how many of them, but it's a 26-episode commitment, and Netflix actually is going to pay $100 million to get the content.
Well, we've sort of presented it more accurately, but the article that I found was in the New York Times, which had a few weird things about it. They said that Netflix was bidding $100 million. I guess $4 million an episode isn't that much anymore for a network drama. I guess that's sort of in the right ballpark.
No, and Netflix has just been spending money on content like you would not believe. They basically have realized one thing, that they're going to get competitors in the streaming content business, and the one thing that will separate them from everybody else is the number of subscribers they have, and that will be dependent on what content they have. You just said it with HBO. Look at all the content they have. Makes me want to do it. You know, makes me want to go online and subscribe to HBO. Or maybe
that's what every channel does. I mean, every cable channel knows they have to have some distinctive original programming to get people to come to their channel. You can build a network with reruns, but then to keep people there and bring new customers in, you have to be AMC and do Mad Men and The Walking Dead, or you have to be the HBO and do what they do. Every channel needs original programming. And Netflix says, you know what, we're just like them.
Right. And people, I've heard the argument made that, well, gee, how can Netflix do this? You know, they're only going to get the subscription revenue. They're not going to get any advertising revenue because, you know, it's not going to be an ad-driven model. Well, you know what? How does HBO make money? They make money solely through premium subscriptions.
Yeah, they want to make you happy that you subscribe to HBO. They want to make you happy that you subscribe to Netflix. And if they give you something you can't get anywhere else, that's one way to differentiate themselves from all the people who are competing. But as I said, I was wondering about the $4 million an episode. That seemed a little high to me, but maybe that's not anymore in the rising cost of network drama television. They also said it was going to be directed by David Fincher. This was in a New York Times article. I'm like, huh? I mean, I assume he's the creator. I doubt he'll direct all 26 episodes. He'd probably do the pilot and the series finale or something like that.
Or he'll be involved in the story arcs.
Right. Well, he'll be the creator and overseer, but I don't think he would direct every episode. Nobody does that in network drama television. So that was a weird thing. They also said it was based on a novel, but they failed to mention the fact that it's one of the most acclaimed British miniseries of all times. The British Film Institute named it just that, one of the 100 greatest British TV shows of all time. So, I mean, this is a very well-known series. I love it. I've watched it. It's terrific.
Well, you know, you've hit upon something there, Michael, because Netflix up until now has always shown content that's already been out in one form or another, whether it was a television show or a movie. They knew how popular the content was before they ever got it. But in this case, they have no idea how popular it is, but really they do. They did a lot of research. They kind of looked at what their audiences and subscribers have watched before and said, you know what, our subscribers, based on what they've seen before and based on the popularity of the book and the British series, we think our subscribers would like this series. And those that don't know about it, we can push the content to them and suggest it to them based on their previous viewing habits. So they're going to save a ton of money in marketing.
Well, I'm sure they'll mention it at least to every single subscriber they have. Why wouldn't they? You know,
yeah,
I don't think
they'd
say, oh, you've only rented, you know, 2.5 Men and we're not interested in pitching this to you. I'm sure every subscriber will get at least one notice. But obviously the ones that are watching more things in line with this will get even more attention.
I mean, Netflix is such a powerful player in this streaming market.
But they know how vulnerable they are, right?
Right. I mean, they control right now, according to NPD, a research group, 61% of all movie streaming in the U.S. The nearest competitor is Comcast Corp's Video On Demand, accounted for just 8%. So they are just killing it. But because of that, now everybody is, as the Hollywood Reporter pointed out, assaulting Netflix or on the gunning for Netflix. You have Amazon. We talked about Facebook last week. Fandor, we've talked about, which is kind of a 2,500 films. Mubi is something new, which is an Indian foreign films. And there's a ton of other competing services, including one called Zediva, which is a $1 online rental. So it's like Redbox, but online.
Yeah, I don't know what this is. So this is a company that's going to let you stream.
Yeah, what it does is they buy all these DVDs. And then they have this big data center with all these DVD players.
Oh, right. This one. Yeah.
And you kind of rent the DVD for 14 days and you control the DVD for, 4 hours. So you
And some schmuck goes over or automatically a DVD gets placed in a player so you can watch it?
Pretty much, yes.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
I look at this and go, why are you doing this? Literally you could go and let's say you wanted to watch The King's Speech if it's out on DVD. It could be out. It could be rented already. You know, now, mind you, they have dozens and dozens of copies of something like The King's Speech. But if they're all out at the time, they're out.
Yeah, that seems a very dorky business model. I wouldn't put a penny into that.
Well, as I wrote in the show notes, I can really smell the lawsuits just already being written for something like this.
Right, because it sort of gets a workaround of legality as far as how they don't own the rights to stream movies, but they feel like they own the right to physically put a CD, DVD into a player and let somebody access that online.
Right. Even if the cord going from the DVD player to your television set happens to be about 450 miles long. But, you know, they're getting around it by the first sale doctrine. I mean, if you buy a DVD, then you have the right to sell it or loan it to somebody. If you license the content, as Netflix does, it's never yours and you never have the right to sell it, which is, we already talked about that earlier in the episode.
And Screen Media is just one more company trying to do something similar.
Yeah, although Screen Media, they have this popcornflix.com, which, you know, they're a distributor in their own right of independent films, but they only have 1,500 film titles. Most of them are low budget. Nobody's ever heard of them. So,
they're throwing their money away. Why are you bothering? Same thing with the company doing the indie art films. I'm sorry, if you've got a couple thousand films in your library, no one's going to subscribe to you. It's not worth the time.
You know, I don't think they're throwing their money away, but the problem is it's all going to boil back down to just a handful of players because you can't confuse your consumers this way. There's too many players now.
That's right. People don't want to have to go to 10 different places to find their movies. And they're certainly not going to subscribe to a bunch of different places. They want ease. They want to go to Blockbuster. They want to go to Netflix. They want to go their cable channel to provide them all the channel. For all the argument people say about picking and choosing your cable channels, they just want you to hand them a couple hundred and let them figure it out. Just make it easy for me.
Right. That's why curation kind of works. I mean, popcornflix.com, you're not going to have to pay to subscribe to. It's going to be free and ad supported. You know, with this Zvidia thing, it's going to be, you know, it's a dollar per movie or, you know, $1.99 per movie, but then it might be rented out already.
But why go to Popcorn Flix? When you're looking for a movie, you get frustrated if you go to a site and go, well, do they have this? Oh, they don't. Do they have that?
Oh, you don't have to convince me that that's a bad idea. Yeah. You know, that is not Zadiva, as it's named, I don't think is, it's like a step backwards.
Yeah.
But, you know, all of these streaming entrepreneurs, as they're called, say that this is really, all of this is just an advantage to consumers because they now have choice and it will drive the cost down. I don't necessarily see that happening.
Well, and of course, with all this action going on, still the good news for Netflix is that Credit Suisse, an analyst there, has just upgraded Netflix from neutral to outperform. They say the company is well positioned for the future, short and long term. They don't see any really big fallout from Amazon offering streaming, and they think Netflix has a lot of room for international growth. And that helped Netflix stock rise today to $220.27. And in the past 12 months, they've gone as low as $70 and as high as $247. So they're near the top of where they have been in the past year.
Do we have to like put in a disclaimer that we are not a financial advisor of any kind?
No, but that's absolutely true. We're not suggesting that. And if you saw my portfolio, you would know why that would not be a good idea.
I take it Apple is not in that portfolio.
If it was, it would be because I bought it yesterday and that wouldn't be very smart.
Right. Precisely.
I just bought gold last week. Let's just put it that way. I'm not too clever.
Well, you know, I would move us on into listener email, but we are already running long. Needless to say, we got a number of emails from listeners telling us or asking us why we didn't mention that that Microsoft was no longer going to manufacture the Zune. And I guess it was frankly because does anybody care? I mean, that's the reason they're no longer manufacturing it. So
it's the end of an era, though.
It's the end of an era. So we should say you can subscribe to our podcast in the Zune marketplace. Or I guess hopefully they'll still have it if it's around. But certainly you can subscribe to it on iTunes, or is it in iTunes? I don't know what the correct verbiage there is. You can also subscribe through RSS. All of those links and links to all of our social networking accounts on Twitter and Facebook, those can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you will find links to all of the stories we've discussed in today's episode, including Brooks Barnes' story on Mars Needs Moms. And thank you very much to Brooks for joining us. It is also where you will find links to all of our past shows. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Now, you can email us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or even give us a call. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. Michael Giltz can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com. That's where you'll find all of his writing. And you can also follow him on Twitter, @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. You can follow me on Twitter, @Sperling is the username to look up. And some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Now, Michael, I don't know about next week because I'm going to be traveling. Hopefully we'll still be able to do a show. If not, until next week or the week after, play nice.